episode 181 of Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry joining me. Barry, today is, I originally planned on it being Bull Nakano Day, but besides Bull Nakano, and we're going to be looking at one of her matches, a great match from the past. Barry, how cool is it? We are joined by a wrestling legend, a tag team legend, Jumpin' Jim Brunzell, going to be joining us, former High Flyer, former Killer Bee, and as you point out during the interview, former one half of the Central States, this is the most important, tag team belts with Mike George, Barry.
Yeah, they didn't have a nickname. We can give them a nickname, but they didn't have one. We didn't, you know. I got to tell you, too, as Jeff said, so this is no secret, we just recorded with Jim Brunzell, and it's Jeff, I'm going to go on a limb. This might be my favorite interview of all time.
You're not the first time you said that, but I think
no.
I'm going to go on a limb just for time considerations and say perhaps you may, depending on Lou's editing skills, you may only hear part one of the interview tonight, but definitely part two. We also want to mention that we reached out to friends of the show, friends of the Facebook group Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry. And let them ask Jim a few questions. This is the kind of thing that we'd like to feature on our Patreon page, which is coming.
It's coming.
I mentioned, by the way, Barry, 1,822 members of our Facebook group kicking ass, taking names. All you other Arcadian groups, just go ahead and suck it because you're looking at our tail feathers. Anyway.
You know what the problem is, Jeff? Those is other shows, they all stick to wrestling.
Hold on. Got that reference out of the way.
Got it.
So anyway, Barry, before we go to the interview with the jumping one, Jim Brunzell, let's talk about why we originally came here today. Bull Nakano Day, the legendary Bull. And we're going to look at her match from November 14th, 1990, inside the steel cage as she takes on Aja Kong. Holy shit, Barry, there is a lot going on here. And by the way, let me just say, for those of you that watched the Britt Baker Thunder Rosa match on AEW, this is similar in style to that match, except accelerated by tenfold and with a finish that will have you jumping out of the proverbial fucking chair. Barry, am I wrong?
Jeff, you are 100% correct.
Check. Okay, we got those two things out of the way. Now, Barry, tell us what you thought about the match.
So I love the match too. So the big difference, look, I'm not getting TNT currently since I made the move because I cut the cord and I chose not to pick up that package, but I did find the match on YouTube or a link someone had sent me. And I got to tell you that Thunder Rosa Britt Baker match is very good. The difference here is there is something culturally that was taking place with the Japanese women. And this was, you know, I remember Meltzer writing in the 80s, early 90s, how this was the hottest promotion in the world. And he was right, because you had believable matchups. You had people that were going to get into a cage that you truly felt hated each other. They weren't acting for the cameras. You really felt they hated each other. But more importantly, everybody watching, everybody in the arena truly believed that these two women hated each other. And this match is, it's really a microcosm of exactly what was taking place between these two women. And I think it's fantastic. To add to it, they both have their respective camps, and their respective camps are, you know, somehow getting involved. They don't go overboard with getting involved, which is great, but they're involved to some degree. So I love this match. First off, this is what a grudge match should be. They do beat the crap out of each other. You and I were talking off air about this match, and there's a point which you brought up the Hangman's noose, and somebody brings in like an electrical appliance and is, you know, she's just wailing. Bull is just wailing Aja Kong over the head. But this match is made by the finish. And spoiler alert, if you don't want to hear about it, mute yourself for 20 seconds or mute us for 20 seconds. And,
We'll come back.
Be able to but please come back, because best interview of all time coming up with Jumpin' Jim Brunzell. But Bull Nakano goes to the top of the cage, and this isn't a cage where the top of the cage is flush with the top rope. This is a cage that it's 15 or 20 foot cage, right, Jeff?
Yeah, it's not your your grandfather's cage. This is a
it's a real steel cage.
Yeah, this is a real cage, and it's like high as fuck. That's all.
It's high as fuck. And so she goes up. Bull Nakano goes to the top of the cage. She stands on top of the cage and then jumps off and delivers, for lack of a better term, the Hogan leg drop. So in your head, picture the Hogan leg drop 20 feet up in the air on somebody's neck and chest. What makes it more incredible is the second she hits it, she bounces up and starts to climb out of the cage. So I don't know how. I don't know how she does that. You know, any of us would have probably laid there for a minute trying to get ourselves and our balance and collect our thoughts. Her ass hits the mat. She bounces up and starts to climb out of the cage. I'm not sure I've ever seen anything ever like that. And to add to this match, Jeff, the after interviews between both women, and then I guess what are their seconds, right? That would have to be their seconds. Who was Aja Kong's second with the wild?
Oh, that's a perfectly reasonable question. I wrote it down. I don't have it with me now. But yeah, there. I know Medusa Michelli is there. And this is as great as I've ever seen Medusa Michelli. Just like, you know, and that's not a knock on her. But she's fantastic outside the ring, brawling with the other, you know, other camp. She's jumping up on the side of the cage, trying to get in. She's getting whacked and falling down off the top of the cage down to the floor. She's fucking fantastic. And let me just say, Barry talked about the move that Bull does, hits the leg drop, bounces up. Barry, that transition and that move is smoother than any transition you've ever heard here on Breaking Kayfabe with Bowden and Barry. Boom.
We are underplaying how fucking amazing that transition was. I'm not quite sure I have ever seen anything ever like that. I don't know how she did that, Jeff. I don't know how she didn't kill Aja Kong. And Aja Kong, she plays it. I mean, she sells this thing for 5 minutes.
Yeah.
So just incredible. But this is one of these matches. Go out of your way. It's 32 minutes from start to finish, which is great because you get the interviews before the match, you get the interviews after the match, and obviously the match. But go out of your way, dedicate the 32 minutes for this. Watch this. You will not be disappointed.
Yeah, and I have to tell you, you know, when Barry says, think of the Hogan leg drop, it never, ever would Hogan hit a leg drop like this. I mean, it's just so beyond any leg drop that I'm trying to even think who hit a leg drop like this. Like, I can't even think, but I will say the trust involved with Aja laying there on the mat as this woman goes to the top of the cage and hits her with those, by the way, can I just say spectacular thighs of Bull Nakano. And she, I had to put that in there for Vandal Drummond, and she hits her. But the fact that Aja lays there, they have so much trust. As she hits her with this leg drop and then bounces up, it's absolutely fucking amazing. And, you know, it's wow. Just, you know, and with all the other shit that's going on outside the ring, I will admit, maybe this isn't a 5-star in the ring spectacular, but when you combine the interviews before the match, the interviews after the match, all the shit. And Barry, here's the word, I think the second time we've used this, the Michigas going on outside the ring with Medusa Michelli, with all the rest of the girls that are getting into it. They're throwing chains inside the ring. They're throwing over the top of the cage. They're throwing the hangman's fucking noose. When I saw that, I go, they're throwing a fucking hangman's noose. of course, the trash cans, the toasters, everything you'd ever want to fucking see in a grudge match is in this fucking match. And when you combine all that, in my opinion, holy shit, Barry, what a fucking amazing match. And you know what's really interesting? You know, when I go and look back sometimes for historical context, and I'll Google the match. And so there is a website, I believe it's called Cage Match or something like that. And they have a group of people that will they'll review a match, and you know, they grade it 1 to 10. And so on this particular match, the grade was like 8.94, something like that. And I was like, really? Well, you know, and I looked and there were like, oh, let's just say for the sake of argument, 35 people that had graded this match. Okay. There were like something along the lines of 27 or 28 that gave it a 10 stars. Okay. Just absolutely legendary match. Then there was like about three or four that gave it a 9-star. And then there was like maybe one or two that gave it 8 stars. And then there's one fucker that gave this match 4 stars out of 10. And I'm like, what fucking match was this guy watching? Because this is absolutely fucking amazing. So I will post a link to this match on our website or Facebook group, Bigger Aching Cafe with Bowden and Barry. And as Barry said, I will hope you go out of your way to check it out. The 30 minutes, as Barry said, does include the introductions with the interviews, the walk up to the ring, then the exit. There's a bunch of shit that happens after the match where, you know, the shoving and the shouting into the microphone. Do I understand what they were saying? Hell no. But, you know, it's still a great match. The outfit that that Bull wears, and I'm not sure if Brian Last, our executive producer, will include this particular photo or not, but she is wearing this thing, and it, you know what it reminded me of, Barry? Do you remember that scene, Barry, in Jurassic Park when Newman from Seinfeld, Wayne Knight, is out there in the car, and he crashes his car trying to get away from the camp and get all the money, and he runs into that creature, and he says, oh, hello, nice little creature, and then the thing all of a sudden has this, like, this hood that comes up, and it, like, attacks Wayne Knight. Do you remember that scene in the movie?
Yes, I absolutely remember that scene.
Yeah, and the outfit that Bull is wearing looks like the hood that creature popped up before it attacked Wayne Knight. I don't know. It's fucking awesome. That's just what it struck me as. I go figure. So anyway, now, Barry, before we continue, you and I have pushed it. We've talked about it. This is an amazing, amazing interview with Jim Brunzell. Could not have been a nicer guy. We are so appreciative of Jim for his time. And we hope that you, the listeners of Breaking Kayfabe with Bowden and Barry, will enjoy this this interview that we did with Jim as much as we did interviewing him. So, Blue, why don't you take it to our interview with Jim Brunzell? Barry, how cool is it that we are joined of one half? We're joined by one half of the former High Flyers, one half of the Killer Bees. It's Jumpin' Jim Brunzell joining us here today on Breaking Kayfabe with Bowden and Barry. Jim, shout out to you. How you doing today, my man?
I'm doing very good. Thanks for having me on.
Barry,
I'm an old relic, you know.
How cool is it to have one half of the High Flyers with us?
Yeah, well, so here's the thing. You know, you got to remember, too, Jim Brunzell was part of three great tag teams. Obviously, the High Flyers, the Killer Bees, which went national in the WWF. But going back to his early days, he was partners with the guy that I actually always felt was really underrated, which was Mike George. But, Jeff, I got to tell you, I don't know if they actually had a name for their team.
I was in the Central States.
Yeah.
That was the, and, I believe you'll agree, that was the highest paying territory that you were ever in, correct?
I used to wrestle 3 times a night for $25.67.
Oh, those early days of your career. So, yeah. Anyway, Jim, we are going to be very happy to talk with you today about your career. So, you know, like we always say, why don't we start at the beginning? Of course, everyone knows you trained at Vern's school along with Flair and I believe Patera, the Iron Sheik. So why don't we start off? You got to have some stories from training at Vern's school. It was like minus 40 degrees and he had you out in the barn. Tell us some stories about those days.
Well, you know, none of us knew what we were looking, you know, getting ourselves into. You know, we had an idea, but you know, it was 6 days a week and it was 4 to 6 hours a day. And Billy Robinson, who was the British heavyweight champion, more or less trained us. And, you know, we'd start out with calisthenics. And one of his big deal was Hindu squats, which is a free squat. And we started out doing, you know, sets of 25. And at the end, we were doing 1,000 free squats a day. 10 sets of 100. And my legs, you know, I used to do, you know, squats and all sorts of stuff, you know, for jumping and football and everything. And my legs were the biggest they've ever been by doing them damn squats. And, you know, Billy used to do submission holds and throws and everything. And then after about 2.5 hours, you know, Vern would come in and then he'd beat the hell out of us, you know, on the mat. So, you know, this went on and on and on. And you know, they really didn't more or less smarten us up until, you know, 2 or 3 days before our first match. So, you know, everybody was wondering what the hell's going on. And, you know, I mean, and you know, Vern was real strict about, you know, wrestling and what he had, you know, what his philosophy was. And it was a great philosophy because, you know, he was very, very successful, multimillionaire, and he had such a great crew here in the AWA when we started, you know, and I think, you know, out of that group, outside of Bob Bruggers, who was a hell of a football player at the University of Minnesota and also a great basketball player in Minnesota high school, you know, he got in that plane crash with Ric Flair and he broke his back and never wrestled again. So outside of that, you know, you got Cosro, Ken, myself, and Greg, and the Nature Boy. You know, we had a hell of a camp that year.
Yeah, Bob is, and I don't know if you know, Bob is slowed down a lot in recent years, but it was working as a bartender at a place in Fort Lauderdale. Jeff and I are both from the Fort Lauderdale, Miami area, South Florida. So Bob is still down there, and his nickname, Jeff, if I'm correct, they call him Gucci. And I'm not sure why they call him Gucci, but he looks to be doing well. So you just mentioned Billy Robinson, and anybody who ever listens to our podcast knows that I am the biggest Billy Robinson mark on the planet. He spent about a year working Florida in 1976, and I was just blown away by his style of wrestling. But I have heard stories that as a teacher and as a trainer, he could be just brutal on trainees. Would that be true?
Yeah, he had sort of a sadistic side to him, you know, and nobody knew more about submissions than him, you know, and he went to that old Wigan camp in England where there was a guy, well, Carl Gotch was there, and then there was a guy named Billy Riley who was the head guy. Yeah. But, you know, they all, you know, took real pride in being able to, you know, grab any part of your body and have you, you know, wet your pants. So he really didn't teach us that much, but he was brilliant in the ring. I remember I had a couple 30-minute draws with him, and I mean, I didn't know how I got into these holds that I had on him. You know, I mean, he was a master, you know, and he was, you know, I went to Japan with him a couple times too, and that's where he really was in his heyday, you know, and I know he and Anuki had some great matches, and you know, I hated to see Billy at the end because, you know, he never took care of himself, and, you know, he had some pretty bad injuries, and his hand was all crippled up, and he had horrible knees, and I know the last I heard he was down in Tennessee, and he was working with kids that were going to go to Japan, so, and then I know he passed away, you know, several years ago, but he was a incredible worker, you know, for his own style.
So let me ask
English you, style.
I kind of jumped ahead there when I was talking about you going to the camp. I know that you had played some football when you were in school. How did you first hear about Vern's school? I mean, did someone ask you to go there? Did you look into it yourself? How did that all start?
Well, when I was a freshman walk-on at the University of Minnesota,
Go Gophers.
You know, and Murray Warmath was a coach, and you know he had a couple of great teams back in '60 and '61 and '62, and then you know, almost all the kids in high school wanted to go to Minnesota, and Greg Gagne, Vern's son, was a walk-on too. So Greg was a quarterback, and I was a wide receiver. So that's where I got to know the Gagne's, and Greg and I hit it off real well. And, you know, a good guy. And actually, Greg was a damn good quarterback. He was just, you know, 170 pounds is a little too small to play running quarterback at the University of Minnesota, you know, because a lot of the plays were geared for their quarterback to option and then also to carry the ball. And Murray Warmath was a firm believer, like all those coaches were in the 60s, you know, 3 yards in a cloud of dust, field position, and the team that makes the fewer mistakes usually wins. So Greg and I became friends, and then Greg invited me over to his house, and you know, Vern had a palatial mansion on Lake Minnetonka, which is the big lake in the suburbs, southern suburbs of Minneapolis. And I remember the first time he had me over there, there was the Viking coaching staff, and Vernon hired this, what they call the galloping gourmet, who was a chef, and his name was Hank Meadows. So I looked at this. He had a huge broiler and grill, and they must have had 40 of these little filet mignons, you know, cooking. And Vern says, he says, Jim, help yourself, have as many as you want. And wow. I had about three or four of those, you know, and they were about 4 or 5 ounce filets, and they were done perfect. And you know, I thought, geez. So right away, I saw how Vern lived. And, you know, well, he was the exception. But at that time, I got to know him. And you know, that my opinion changed a little bit, you know, when I worked for him, because he was pretty damn hard to work for in terms of, you know, it was all him. It was all his way or nothing. So, and, you know, they had made me partners with Greg when I came back from Japan and in late 74. And that was the beginning of the High Flyers. And, you know, we had, you know, like I said so many times, I mean, the talent in the AWA was just incredible. And everybody wanted to go to the AWA because you only worked 14 to 16 times a month, and then you had time off in the summer, you know, whereas when I went to, when it was down in Kansas City, you know, you worked 7 days a week, 2 to 3 times a night, you never had a day off. And then, when I went to, Mid-Atlantic, you know, in Charlotte in 1979, you wrestled every day too. And then sometimes twice on Saturday and Sunday. So, you know, I mean, it was ideal here in Minnesota. I hated to leave Minnesota when I went to New York, but I'm sort of skipping ahead now, but, you know, that was in, you know, 85, but, Minneapolis was just an incredible place. And they had, you know, so many great guys, Nick Bockwinkel, Bobby Heenan, Billy Superstar Graham, Wahoo McDaniel, Mad Dog Vachon, the Crusher. You know, Bobby Duncan, Jack Lanza. I mean, there was such great talent here that, you know, and there was only like 14 guys, and everybody knew their position, and everybody, you know, he made good money and he had time off, which was ideal in this business.
Yeah, it's one thing, and I've got a copy of your book, which is True Stories from the Wrestling Road Matlands by Jumpin' Jim Brunzell. I picked this up from you, and this was the nicest thing ever, Jim. I picked this up from you 6 years ago, actually. It was March of 2015, and I know that because you actually inscribed it to my son. It says, Zach, all the best for nothing but good health. Prosperity, study hard and play harder. Enjoy my stories. Peace, Jumpin' Jim Brunzell. And it was March of 16. But you said a couple of things. You actually said a lot that I wanted to touch on. One was, any listener to our podcast, and Jim, I don't know if you know, we are a Peabody award-winning podcast.
Multiple Peabody awards.
Multiple Peabody awards. Oh, absolutely. It's yeah. But two things. You mentioned the Minnesota Vikings, which I think Jeff is going to want to talk to you off air for about 6 hours. Because possibly the biggest Viking fan that's never lived in Minnesota ever in the history of the
never
world.
Never been there. Never been there.
Been to Minnesota. And my hobby, Jim, is food. You're talking about filet mignons and take as many as you want. And I'm sitting over here and my mouth is watering. But I know we've got you for a limited time. You are coming courtesy of our old friend, Nick Massey, who does Captain's Corner Happy Hour and has a Captain's Corner Happy Hour with you, Jim Brunzell, coming up 7 p.m. Friday, April the 2nd. Very exciting. Nick is a tremendous human being. We have had many conversations with Nick, and we've interviewed, you know, plenty of the guys that he's worked with. Just, I think, the world of Nick. I know Jeff does as well. But you are going to have, I guess, trunks. You're going to auction off some of your trunks. There's a rumor that you may have masks as well. Will you have copies of your book as well during that auction?
Yeah, I think Nick wanted me to bring 15 or 20 of them. I think I have that. So I'll bring them. You know, the book was, you know, and a lot of guys write books, but a lot of guys use ghostwriters, you know, and I collected these stories for 5 years, and, you know, my wife had the manuscript and she printed it all up, and I had all my own, you know, personal photos. And it was just, you know, it was really a sort of a work of love, because I wanted to, you know, tell the people in a way, you know, what it was like to be on the road, because, you know, people have no idea what it was like to be a pro wrestler, especially in the early days. And, you know, they watch TV and they say, okay, yeah, they're making TV and they're talking about their opponent this, and then they're going to wrestle their opponent in, you know, Minneapolis or St. Paul. And then they really didn't know that, you know, we did interviews for like, you know, 20 towns. So, it, you know, that same match might have happened in Denver, Chicago, Milwaukee, Green Bay, Winnipeg. Where the hell else did we go? I went to Quad Cities, and then, you know, then you'd have spot shows in between. So, you know, it was, but again, I want to go back to Minnesota in terms of, you know, the best working conditions that I was, you know, able to do in my early years, you know, pro wrestling. You know, and it was such a change going to New York, because, you know, Vince, you know, he had 60 guys and he had, you know, 3 towns a night. And that's, I remember for 3.5 years, Brian and I actually averaged 27 days a month. That's how many days we were on the road. And we went 52 or 54 days in a row. And Greg Valentine broke my hand in Rockford, Illinois, and had to go home, and they had to let it sit for one day. So the swelling went down. They put a cast on. And then in the next 3 weeks, I won more matches clotheslining people with that mask than I ever did with any drop kicks.
So, well, Jim, one of the things that we did from our Facebook group, Breaking Kayfabe with Bowden and Barry, I reached out to a couple of people that are very active in our group. And I said, I'm going to give you the chance, if you would like to ask the great Jim Brunzell some questions, those of you that were fans of his back in the day. So I'm going to read you a couple questions, and if you could answer them for us, we'd certainly appreciate it. The first one comes from our old friend, Chris. By the way, Barry, his name is pronounced Chris Zauta. We've been getting it wrong for 180 episodes.
What? Chris Zauta?
Yes. It is pronounced Zauta. So that's what I had an inside source tell me. Chris never bothered to tell us. Anyway, Jim, Chris wanted to know, he said he remembers some matches that you had against Nick Bockwinkel in the early 80s, was very appreciative of your matches with Nick. Of course, Nick, one of the all-time legends in business. And Chris wanted to know, any thought given to you perhaps having a run with the belt, whether it be short term, long term, anything like that?
Never in the AWA. Yeah. That would have been, you know, they had plans for me with Greg, and that's as far as it went. I had, you know, I consider Nick Bockwinkel, God rest his soul, to be one of the greatest, you know, the top five of any of the guys I ever worked with. I mean, it was a fight for your life, but we worked our rear ends off. And I remember I had a match with him, and I think it was 1975, and it was an hour draw in St. Paul, and it was by far the best match I ever had. And then we had an incredible match in Winnipeg that was an hour long. And then I think we had another hour in Denver, but it was just, you know, Nick was, his timing and everything he did in the ring meant something. And he'd build a story and, you know, he'd stop me. And it was just a real work of art, you know, being in the ring with him. And he was a wonderful guy. And, you know, and the thing that complimented him you know, was Bobby Heenan, who I consider the greatest all-around talent of my era, because he could do anything. I mean, he could, you know, he could go in the ring and work, and he could talk, and he was just, he was incredible, you know. And Vince, you know, worked Bobby to death. You know, I remember sometimes Bobby would go out, you know, in a match, you know, three or four different guys, you know, during the course of an evening, you know. And then he, you know, we had TV 2 days in a row, and it was 8 hours a day. And then we flew up to Canada, another 6 hours up there, and, you know, countless interviews. And Bobby was just, you know, the best.
Well, let me ask you a question. This might seem like a ridiculous question, but do you think in some ways that Nick is underrated historically by fans, and almost like, do you think, as great as he was, and I'm certainly not trying to minimize it at all, because Barry and I definitely realized how great he was, do you think he was underappreciated by Vern?
No, I think Vern really was fortunate to have him here, because he realized Nick was exactly the type of heel that he wanted, a wrestling heel, and who, along with Bobby, did great interviews, and who could work with him in all over the, you know, the different cities in the EWA. He could work with Billy Robinson. I mean, you know, and he had a couple matches with the Crusher, which were, and Nick could work anyway in the ring, but I mean, that was, Vern loved the wrestling heel. He just loved the wrestling heel, because, you know, they used to have incredible matches. And I remember this was towards the end of my career, and I want to say it was in the late 80s. We were down in Atlanta for some pay-per-view, and Nick Bockwinkel worked against Dory Funk, and I think they had a 30-minute draw, and it stole the show. It was by far the best match of the night. It was incredible. It was really something. And I was in a six-man tag, and I think it was Wahoo, myself, and I can't remember who it was, but we were against Morocco and Dick Murdoch and somebody else. And I remember the very first deal that happened, I had a headlock on Murdoch, and he threw me and dropped down. And then as I came off the rope, he drop kicked me, and he says, "Hey, kid, I can drop kick too." And I don't know if you knew who Dick Murdoch was, but he was, he was crazy, but he was so gifted in the ring. God, he was good in the ring. Him and Dusty Rhodes were just incredible, you know, when they were together. Oh boy.
Yeah, we always talk about Dick Murdoch as a Hall of Fame wrestler, and sadly, I think the last place he worked would have been Smoky Mountain. Somewhere around probably the mid 90s, somewhere right around there, maybe the early 90s. But what a talent he was. Another guy that was a real talent. And Jeff, how was that for a segue?
Boy, you're the king of segues, Bear.
Well, maybe the prince, Jeff. I consider you the king of segues, so I'll be the prince, the crown prince. But another guy that I always felt was a hell of a talent, really maybe never got the push he deserved in any territory, was Jeff Ports. And I know that... Yeah. Jeff is a guy that you know extremely well, that you worked with, but there's a great story out there about you and Jeff Ports on a commercial flight from Minneapolis to Chicago. Would you mind sharing that story? Okay.
Well, you know, we did TV, and then we were flying. We had like a 5 o'clock flight from Minneapolis to Chicago. It's only 45 minutes. And then we were going to go to the amphitheater. So Jeff and I were traveling together, and he was just a wonderful guy and a multi-talented guy. He was a tough guy too. I mean, he could, so we're sitting on the plane, and there was a kid, and the plane must've been, you know, it must've come from California before, because there was a kid that was sort of, well, he was drunk. He was inebriated, and he was sitting right behind us, and he was given the stewardess a hard time because she refused to serve him any more, you know, liquor. And he was, you know, calling her this and that. And finally I turned around and I said to him, I said, "Hey," I said, "knock it off." And he says, "F you." And Jeff Ports was sitting right next to me. He unbuckled his seatbelt and he looked back at the kid, and the kid tried to get up and Jeff headbutted him in the nose. And he headbutted him so hard, the kid hit the back of his seat and the blood flew out. It hit Jeff, but it almost hit me. And the kid was knocked semi-unconscious. Meanwhile, the stewardesses were going absolutely crazy because, you know, we're 30-some thousand feet. And here this kid, his nose was completely smashed. And Jeff says, Jeff wanted to, you know, beat the shit out of him. And thank God. I said, oh, God, Jeff, please, you know. And then the captain says, he gets on the horn and he says, okay, he says, who's ever fighting on the back of the plane, stop. Otherwise, he says, we're going to have the police waiting our arrival. So Jeff sat back and I sat back and the kid had this huge towel over his head. And he kept yelling. He says, I don't know what hit me. I don't know. He didn't punch me. I have no idea. But, you know, the towel was completely red. So the plane landed and these cops come on and we walk off the plane and the steward said, this gentleman here, you know, helped us and I'm glad he did. And so the cops didn't do nothing to us, but they put the handcuffs on this kid and pulled him away. But I mean, to see this on an airline, you know, that was full at 30 some thousand feet, it just, you know, it took me by surprise too. You know, I thought, well, this kid, you know, he's drunk and whatever. But Jeff just said, oh, you know, wham, and boy, that headbutt. And you know, the Englishmen were known for headbutting. I mean, and that is just a heck of an offensive weapon because if you hit somebody in the snoot or in the mouth with your forehead. And you know how it is, just to bump heads accidentally, it stuns you. Well, if this guy, you know, is actually geared up, you know, and cranks his head, you know, this kid just, I mean, if you could have seen it slow motion, you would have seen this kid. The kid was lucky he didn't get a concussion.
No, I can just imagine as the
but
cops.
But he deserved it.
As the cops
but
are
he deserved
on the plane,
every bit of it.
The steward is saying, yes, officer, the kid with no nose, that's the one we need to arrest.
The kid's nose is shoved down his anus at this point.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
But, so we went on. We went to Chicago and nothing ever, you know, happened. You know, they didn't arrest Jeff or anything or question us. But, you know, that was just something that happened, you know. It was just out of the ordinary. But.
So, okay, Jim.
Our next
question is going to come from Barry. It's your old friend Joe Stassi. Loves to talk food with Barry and Jim.
Yes,
but Joe asking Jim, what were your thoughts about working with the late Bruiser Brody? He's always heard that Frank could work a little stiff. Did you enjoy working with him or not?
Well, Frank was a great guy, and I'll relate a story to you. You know, I had worked with him and he'd come into Minneapolis and I had been kicked in the groin and I had a vasectomy about 6 months earlier. And what had happened was when I got kicked, it ruptured these stainless steel sutures that were inside. I had like a blood clot in there.
I'm crossing my leg. Just
yeah, I may have to put down the headset.
Well, it was painful too. It was painful. So Vern says, well, we'll take advantage of this and we'll bring Brody in and have him jump off the top rope onto you. And then, you know, you'll be out. So I was out like 4 or 5 weeks and they brought Frank and I back and we brought back to Denver and what had happened there before when Frank was working with somebody as he was walking to the ring, you know, security wasn't very good. And this guy had jabbed him with something and Frank turned around and flattened the guy. And this guy pressed charges and there was a lawsuit and Vern didn't back him up, you know? So the next time we got into Colorado, you know, I was supposed to be mad, you know, mad at him because, you know, here he had, you know, laid me up and jumped on my belly and da, 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 da. So I go into the ring with him and he wouldn't tie up with me and he wouldn't, he went underneath the rope. I said, Jesus Christ. So during the match, I was, you know, vehemently mad at him. So I went and all of a sudden he jumped out of the ring. He went to the locker room. So I, Jesus Christ. So I, Jesus God, I go into the locker room. I says, Frank, I says, God damn it. I says, come on, you got to go in the ring. He says, no. He says, just forget it. He says, it has nothing to do with you. This is for Vern, for not backing me. So that was it. He got counted out. And I thought, you know, the fact was here, you know, everybody was waiting for this return match, although I did have some good matches with them. And I told him, you know, we had a match in St. Paul, and I told him before the match, I says, Frank, I says, now remember, I said, this is my hometown. I said, don't kill me in my hometown. And we had a great match. And you know, I think, Frank did incredibly well in Japan. You know, he was a talented guy. Good, you know, he played football with the Washington Redskins. And this is the honest gospel truth. Shortly, 2 days before he was murdered in Puerto Rico, he was in the Kansas City airport, and I was there too, and we had breakfast together. And I said, he asked me, where are you going? I said, well, I'm going to Texas. And he says, I said, where are you going? He says, well, I got unfinished business in Puerto Rico. He said, the promotion there is trying to screw me. So, and then 2 days later, I find out, you know, he was murdered in the shower. And I thought, my God, you know, and it was a tragedy. And, you know, to this day, they never did prosecute, what's his name, Gonzalez. And there was a couple guys who were in the locker room who I won't mention, that knew, you know, exactly what happened. And they didn't speak up, and they were threatened too. They said if they had, you know, said anything about what transpired, that they would be, you know, hunted down and killed. So I think after that, I don't think very many guys went down to Puerto Rico to work.
Yeah, one of the things too that I really liked about your book, you had talked a little bit earlier about the camaraderie of the AWA guys, and there are so many photos in your book. Again, the book, True Stories from the Wrestling Road, Matt Lands by Jumpin' Jim Brunzel. But there are so many photos of you with guys that you were working with, and it's baby faces, it's heels, it's everybody. But you do get this impression that possibly because it was a smaller territory, as far as the amount of talent there, that everybody seemed extremely close. But during your time in the Mid-Atlantic area, you got to work with a guy that I consider a legend, which was the original Nature Boy, Buddy Rogers. And there was a match, you and Ricky Steamboat, and that's a hell of a team right there, wrestling against Jimmy Snuka and Buddy Rogers. That's amazing. What really stands out about that match for you and being able to work with Buddy, who obviously, you know, I was going to say on the tail end of his career, but, you know, exactly. Realistically, he had been retired for a decade even prior to that, except for a couple of months in Florida. So what was it like getting in the ring with somebody like that?
Well, first of all, you got to realize that George Scott was the booker, and George Scott idolized Buddy Rogers. That was his big hero, you know, the 50s. He was incredible. Well, so Buddy Rogers came there, and, you know, everybody had heard of him, you know, in different territories, manipulating himself, you know, to get the heat and everything. So, you know, he was sort of managing Jimmy Snuka, another brilliant worker, God rest his soul. So we had this match, and, you know, Buddy Rogers used to do a tanning bed. He had his own tanning bed. and he'd get on under this tanning bed. He was all brown all year long. And also during the course of interviews and when he'd go to and from the match, he'd wear bandages, these big, you know, band-aids over his ears. So he could, you know, block out the noise from the people booing him. So he's in the ring and, it's my turn to make a comeback. So he's in the ring and he's cowering in the corner. And so he's got the bandages on his ears. And I pulled one bandage off and he sold it like son of a gun. And then I pulled another bandage off his ear and he sold it like son of a gun. And then, you know, he had this big bandage over his chest. And little did I know that he had burned himself and he had blistered his chest with the sun lamp. So I jerked this band-aid off his chest and yanked it off. And he let off with a scream. And as I peeled him out of the corner, he said to me, he says, I bet if you had a few more seconds, he said, you'd take my boots off. And I never worked with him again.
That was,
yeah.
Go figure, right?
So. Yeah. Yeah, well next, you know, he was the, okay, go ahead.
No, please, continue.
Well, you know, he used to have this big diamond ring, and he'd do these interviews, and, you know, Flair was there, and he called himself the Nature Boy and everything. And he'd look at this ring, and he'd twirl it around on his finger, and he'd look at the crowd, and he'd say, you know, he says, there's only one diamond in this business. And he says, Ric Flair, isn't it? That's what he'd say, you know.
So, well, listen, I want to go back to our questions, and we're going to go off the wrestling topic. Son of Minnesota, Glenn Braggett. He may know a thing or two about you, Jim. And Jim, he kind of, Barry, I don't know if you're going to like this, he broke kayfabe on us. Oh, what? Yes. Uh-oh. He told us that perhaps Jim, a fan of a certain Son of New Jersey. So yes. Glenn wanted me to ask you, Jim, give us your top five Bruce Springsteen songs.
Oh, man.
Putting you on the spot.
The first song I ever heard of Bruce was Jungle Land. And that's one that it was about 6-7 minutes long. And I was coming back from a small airplane ride, and I listened to it and I thought, Jesus Christ, it, you know, went on and on and on. It was sort of like an opera and I couldn't figure out, and they never mentioned the damn singer. So a couple days later, I told my wife, I said, God, I heard this damn song on the way home and I didn't know who it was. And then I heard, you know, Born to Run. And then, I thought, geez, I'm going to get this record. And then I listened to the record, and then I got every record that I, you know, the other two, his first records, you know, Greetings and the other one. So I became enthralled with Bruce Springsteen, and he's just incredible. And I got to meet him too. I got to meet him in 84, and I've probably seen Bruce, my wife and I, and some other people. And well, Mary and I have seen him about 80 times.
Wow. I guess you are a fan,
huh? Since 1978. And actually, I sent him the book because I have a chapter in there about him, the Magic Rat. And it was just, you know, something about him resonated with me. And once I saw him and saw how hard he worked, you know, in these 3-hour shows, it was just incredible. So, you know, I just, you know, I was very fortunate. And then a friend of mine who was actually, his name was Terry McGovern, another guy who passed away, was Bruce's right-hand man for 23 years. Wow. And he was a wrestling fan. So there was my big in. So I remember when this happened, I can't remember what year it was, but I think it had to be in the early 90s. they brought us out to New York for some big signing, and Terry McGovern wanted to go. So I says, well, come on, you know, and I'll get you a ticket. So he sat with Brian and I up at our table, and, you know, all the other guys were there. And so they asked me, you know, people said, well, who's the guy with me? And Terry says, I'm the security for the Killer Bees. So it was fun. And, you know, he really made it so much easier, because I, you know, trying to meet somebody like Bruce Springsteen is pretty damn hard. And, you know, I mean, there's, you know, there's 20,000 people who want to meet him every night. Sure. And he's been very good, you know, to me and my family, my wife, who he likes a lot more than me. I get jealous of her because he kisses her. And I remember the last time I saw him, I think it was 2016. I gave him a big hug and he looked at me like, hey, easy. You know, but yeah, he's
well, let me you ask, know, you
can't say enough good about him.
You saw like 80 of his shows. Which venue, yep, do you remember seeing him at that you enjoyed his show the most? You know, combination, great show, great venue.
Well, twice. I saw him in Chicago at a small, it was called the Uptown Theater in 78. And I was guest of this Andy Frain security. So we go there and I have my wife and I have a dear friend who's a photographer. You know, his name was Mike Gratchner, wonderful photographer. And he has Mike. A number of pictures. Yep. Yeah, great guy. And, yeah, and just loved wrestling. And so he's with us too. And I go and I says, tickets for Jim Brunzel from Andy Frain security. And they says, geez, there's no tickets here. And I said, you got to be kidding me. And they said, no. And I said, oh, God. I said, well, what, you know what? And they said, it sold out. And I said, oh, shit. So they had a huddle. And then they said, well, here's what we're going to do. We're going to put you right down in the orchestra pit, right down from Bruce's microphone. So the three of us sat there for this three-hour show. And he was 3 feet away from us. And that was an incredible show because, you know, you watched him constantly, you know, go back and forth and play the guitar incredibly. And then the other time we were guests of Terry and we were at Miller Stadium in Milwaukee, and there was 65 or 67,000 people there. And Terry put us right on the stage, right behind the guitar tech. So it had like a little apron and a little housing. So we were right on the stage about 20 feet from Bruce during the whole show. And it was incredible to see that. And then actually to see the machinations of the concert, you know, behind the scenes, you know, they had behind the actual stage, the stage is just mammoth. They had like a little bar in the very back, and they had, oh, cripe, I don't know. They had place for press and everything. And then, you know, it was just unique that we had the opportunity to, you know, to be in, you know, be at the concert, let alone, you know, right on stage with them. So it was great.
Yeah. Let me tell you. So I met Bruce Springsteen once. And I got to tell you, of all the
name
celebrities
dropper.
I met, oh, absolutely. We're good friends now. It's like, oh, yeah, he sees me. He's like, yeah, we'll go get a beer, right? So I was working, Jeff, you will like the beginning of this at least. I was working at a restaurant in New York City. And this
server
was...
Server or manager?
Yeah, I was a manager. Okay. And it was 1998. I had been married, I think, for 2 or 3 months. And I should say, my wife, when she was a kid... Her idol was Bruce Springsteen. She wanted to be Bruce Springsteen. She had a red bandana she would wear. She knew every word to every song and every meaning of every lyric. So she literally lived and breathed Bruce Springsteen. We're married for 2 months. I look out the window. It's this quiet night on the street. It's summer. And here comes Bruce Springsteen walking with his wife and nobody's bothering him. So who's the asshole who's going to go bother him? this guy. I grab a menu, I hightail it and run outside, and I'm like, Mr. Springsteen, you know, I'm dog just pulled off my my microphone and my headset. So
we
I
are nothing if that. Not professional.
Dog decided to sit on me and just rip everything off. So I run out there and I'm like, Mr. Springsteen, and I'm blathering like an idiot, and I'm explaining to him about my wife, and God bless him, he and his wife stood there and listened to every word that I was saying. I'm sure I was making no sense, and then signed the nicest autograph for my wife. And I just thought that was just the nicest thing that anybody could have ever done. But what a guy. And speaking of autographs, again, the Prince of Segways, Jeff.
There you go.
coming up Friday, April the 2nd, 7 p.m. It is Captain's Corner Happy Hour with Jim Brunzell. This is obviously a virtual autograph signing, but Nick has done probably 100 of these in the last year. I tune in whenever I can because I just think everybody has so much fun. But what I think is cool, again, in reading your book, True Stories from the Wrestling Road, Matt Lands, you are also an autograph collector, Mr. Brunzell.
Well, I had two or three autographs that stand out. One was Joe Namath. And of course I have several from Bruce. And then, I had, as a young kid, I was a Yankee fan in the late 50s, and there was a pitcher by the name of Bob Turley who pitched for the Yankees, and I sent him a letter, and he sent me a doggone, you know, a little postcard of him, and that was one. And then Ted Koppel, who I spent about an hour and a half with at one of those West Orient travel clubs. And he was flying. I can't remember. He was going to Washington and I was going to Buffalo, New York, and we're in Chicago and they had horrible weather. So we're in this doggone room for an hour and a half. And I walked in there and it was just he and I. So I walked up to him and I said, Mr. Koppel, my name is Jim Brunzell. I said, I'm a big fan of Nightline. And I just want to tell you, what a wonderful job. And he just sat down. So we sat and talked about everything from the Kennedy assassination to pro wrestling. And then he signed an autograph for me and I stuck it in my jacket and didn't think anything of it. And then when I got to Buffalo, I took it out and I looked and I thought, Jesus Christ, I wonder which way I'm supposed to hold this paper so I can read it, because it was, you couldn't read it. It looked like hand scratching. So, you know, that was, I thought, and it was funny because about a week or 2 weeks later, he had a amateur wrestler on talking about pro wrestling and sort of, you know, knocking it a little bit. And I thought, So it was sort of fun, you know, sitting there talking with him and, luck be it. And, we traveled every day, and we took airplanes every day. So there was an opportunity that we were, you know, going to meet people. And this is the honest to gospel truth. In Winnipeg, I didn't put this, I don't know if I put this in my book, but I don't think so. So in Winnipeg, we stayed downtown and, we would wrestle and then we'd go to a place called High Steakloaf, which was there was about three or four of them in Canada and they were spectacular, just incredible steakhouse. So we eat and I'm going, I get back, take a cab, boom, I'm going up to my room and I get in the elevator and go up one floor and all of a sudden this gentleman comes in and I look at him and it's Harry Chapin.
Oh.
And I look at him and I said to him, I said, you're Harry Chapin. He said, yeah. He says, I'm playing tomorrow night in Winnipeg. So, you know, and then it, God almighty, it was shortly thereafter he got killed. But I just, you know, it was just dawned on me that, you know, all of a sudden you walk, you know, the elevator opens and a guy stands there, walks in and you think, holy cripe, you know. So I've been fortunate, you know, and You know, it's what can you say? You know.
All right, as a Vikings fan, I'm just for my own personal self. tell me which Vikings autograph you have that you value the most.
Oh God, I've got one from Fran Tarkington.
Nice.
And I'll tell you this. I wanted to have a tryout with the Vikings, and at that time, their head scout was a tight end who used to play with the Vikings. His name was Jerry Rykow, and he told me, he called me back and he says, Jim, he says, here's the deal. He said, the chances of you making the Vikings are slim to none. And he says, we hate to cut University of Minnesota football players. So that was it with the Vikings. But I had a dear friend, Jeff Wright, who played.
Oh, yeah. Number 23.
Yep. Yeah. And he was a great athlete. He and I played at the University of Minnesota together. And he was, and I knew a lot of guys that played, you know, with the Vikings. And I had, you know, Jimmy Carter, who I played football with. He took Ray Nitschke's job at Green Bay, and he played with the Packers for 8 years. So, and I knew a lot of guys that, you know, that went to the Vikings, and you know, I suffered through 4 Super Bowl losses.
You and me both, brother.
I'll tell you this. We had parties then, and by halftime, you couldn't drink enough to bury your sorrows because the game was over at halftime. Every single game, I thought, my God.
I was just 14 and 15, and I would have joined you in those drinking parties.
Oh, God. We used to have parties, you know, 40 people, and then pretty soon everybody says, well, should we turn the damn game off now and just, you know, get into the gigs?
Let me go back to the questions. Next question is from veteran wrestling promoter Howard T. Brody, who wants to know, when you were a member of the High Flyers with Greg, which team during your AWA run that you two worked with did you consider a veritable night off? In other words, the other team's so good, you considered it a night off.
Probably Bockwinkel and Stevens. Incredible. I mean, Jesse and Adrian were good, but it was, you know, Adrian was a hell of a bump guy, you know, and he made that team. And Jesse was very good on the mic, and they complimented each other very well, the East-West connection. But, you know, Greg and I had some matches. We had a hell of a draw with Rick Martel and Tito Santana.
We actually reviewed that match.
We reviewed that match. Yeah.
It was a tremendous match.
Yeah. And, oh, it was a great match. And honest to God, I mean, you know, there was, like I said, so much talent there. But, you know, it was, you know, and then when Ray Stevens and Pat Patterson were teamed up too, they were an incredible team. I remember, Pat Patterson came running off the the ropes real hard, and I nailed him right in the chin with a drop kick, and he hit his head on the mat real hard, and it knocked him silly. So he sort of rolled out of the ring, and he was on the floor, and they were counting him, and Ray Stevens thought, geez, they're going to count him out. So Ray went to throw him back in the ring, and Pat was still woozy on his feet. And when he threw him back into the ring, Pat's head went right into the side of the apron, and he went back down on the floor. And I thought they almost counted him out, and then finally they got him back in. But he was cross-eyed for about 3 minutes, and then finally Stevens got tagged back in. But yeah, they were a hell of a team too. There was a lot of good teams, but you know, Nick and Ray were incredible. They were probably one of the best tag teams that were around at that time.
Yeah, and Jeff, we did Jeff and I have been doing our podcast now, Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry. We're about 3.5 years. We've never missed a show, which is pretty incredible. Weekly, but we did one on tag team wrestling, and I think we had, Jeff, am I right? Didn't we have Stevens and Bockwinkel is like one of the top tag teams, if not the greatest tag team of all time.
Yeah, they were definitely in the mix. Did you ever, just curious, did you ever work with the team of Stevens and Patterson, or the other combination of Stevens and Bockwinkel? Like, did you have a particular favorite of those three guys?
Well, I think, you know, I think Nick and Ray Stevens were a little better than Pat and Stevens, because Pat was sort of a character, you know, and he would, you know, work the crowd more, where Nick was so damn good in the ring, you know, that, and everything he did, you know, told a story. And I'm not knocking Pat at all. You know, there's another guy. I mean, so many, they're all gone now, you know. I mean, I talked to Jim Rasky, the Baron, and he's 81. And I said, geez, Baron, I said, I haven't talked to you for a year. I just want to make sure you're okay, because you're one of the last of the Mohicans, you know, out of that big group that they had, you know. He says he's fine. So that's good. But, I know I got off the beaten track of your question, but yeah, I think without a doubt, you know, Bockwinkel and Stevens were probably the greatest tag team we worked with.
Okay.
Gotcha. And one of the guys you mentioned too was Adrian Adonis, and Adrian and Jesse Ventura. But if I'm correct too, I believe I did read this in your book. Were you there the night that Dan Spivey and Adrian Adonis got into the dressing room brawl in Flint, Michigan?
Yep. I went into the ring, because that's when it first started. And it was a horrible night. And I felt bad for both of them, but I felt really bad for Adrian, because he almost got killed. You know, I mean, I never seen anybody get hit that hard. You know, and what had happened, you know, Danny was new. He came in and, you know, big guy. And this is what Danny Spivey, one of the things that he is most proud of. And he was supposedly the only white pimp in Tampa, Florida.
I think he's got a plaque. Doesn't he have a plaque?
Right.
So, but I tell you what, you know, he was a tough son of a gun. And he came in there. And Adrian would always, you know, Adrian would always sort of, you know, try to, well, he wouldn't, but he'd take liberties with some guys, and he was rough. And he wound up putting the sleeper on Danny Spivey really hard. So Danny had warned him. He says, you know, Adrian, please. He says, don't be rough with me. I'm going to come back on you. And sure enough, Flint, Michigan, he slapped the sleeper on him, and Spivey hit him with an elbow and, you know, got him to break the hold. And then he kicked him, boom. And he opened him up on the side of the eye. And then, I mean, Bob Orton and I ran to the ring and tried to talk Danny Spivey and just say, Danny, get out of here. Come on. So they go to the ring, or they go to the locker room, and then Adrian comes in and, you know, says, hey, what's going on? Da, da. And what he does was he went to leg dive Danny Spivey, and Danny Spivey came up with an uppercut and hit him right on the side of the cheek, and hit him so hard that it sounded like he collapsed his jaw. And Adrian went up in the air about 2 or 3 feet and landed flat. You know, he was flat. His legs hit flat, and his arms hit flat, and his head hit flat. And when he looked up, I could see the bone sticking through his cheek.
Ooch.
His upper cheek. And he never was the same after that. He, you know, that was a severe concussion he had, and he just never got back. You know, he gained so damn much weight, and it was bad. And then, you know, shortly thereafter, I guess, you know, he went to Japan. came back from Japan and then was working in Montreal, and they ran off the road and he got killed. And oh God, it was horrible. Matter of fact, some fellows from Toronto called me and wanted to know if I'd be interested in doing or being part of a documentary on him. And I said, yeah. I says, well, you know, just keep me posted. They never called back. But yeah, it was a shame, you know, because something like that happens in the business. And I mean, it's horrifying because, you know, guys are split, you know, they've been on the road so long and that, you know, you don't know what's going on at home that bothers them. Or, you know, a lot of them, you know, had substance abuse and you know, I mean, if you work 27 days a month and you fly every day, that's going to affect you, you know, just like COVID has, you know, being Groundhog Day every goddamn day of the, you know, week is always seems the same after a period of time, you know, mentally it takes its toll. Well, the same thing happens is when you're on the road. And if you don't have a strong family and a strong wife, it's going to present problems. And there was countless, you know, couples that, you know, endured a lot of anxiety and just stress on the road. I mean, it was just, it's not normal. And, you know, people didn't realize that, you know, we were wrestling. You know, I remember the Sheik. You know, Khosrow wrestled so many times and he went home one time and he was gone for so long that his wife redid the house and he drove right by it. He didn't even recognize it. So, you know, I mean, that was one of the big, you know, letdowns as far as it was, you know, at the WWE, because, you know, when there was 26 territories, you could wrestle everywhere. Then when Vince, you know, took all the talent, there was only a couple of places you could wrestle. One was Japan and one was the WWE. So you had to put up with all that. And then consequently, Vince wanted to change the whole, what everybody knew as professional wrestling in terms of building a match in the town, you know, building to crescendo as either a king of the, you know, or what, a fence match or cage match or whatever. He didn't do that. You know, he would have Hulk Hogan in LA against somebody and they do, you know, $230,000 at the gate and they wouldn't work a match to come back. They'd come back with somebody totally different that didn't mean anything. And that's was Vince's undertaking on what he was trying to do. He went against what all the wrestling promotions had done for years. And Vince got away with it because he had a TV that was second to none and he had all the talent in the world. So, you know, I'd ask George Scott, you know, who was the booker there, who George Scott fired me down in Carolina. And then, you know, I used the booker up in New York when I get there. And I thought, oh my God, you know, and then, you know, I mean, you were booked, you just didn't dare ask for a time off. You know, I mean, it was just unmerciful, but you know, I mean, that's, if you wanted to wrestle, you had to go to WWE.
Okay, Jim, next question comes from our old friend, Mark Small, who wants to know, in fact, were the Central States Tag Team belts the ugliest belts you ever wore as a title holder? There may be some sarcasm in that question.
Well, you know, I mean, when you look at the promoters down there, it was Bob Geigel and Pat O'Connor. And and they,
wait a minute, are you trying to intimate there may have been some cheapness there?
There was a lot of cheapness. And consequently, I think that I think Reggie Parks made those belts and they were probably made in, you know, probably the early 60s, and they were sort of brassy, so you had to take some brass polish to make them shine a little bit. But, you know, after being in the business only about 8 months and winding up, you know, being a tag team champion, I was thrilled. And Mike George, I remember you saying, was underrated. And he was. He was, you know, he was a big baby face and he was a amateur wrestler, but he was very good in the ring. He had good psychology, good bumps and everything. And I think, you know, I think he made a decent living as a heel in Louisiana and Texas and Oklahoma, but he never really got a you know, a break. And I've tried to get a hold of him, but I have no idea. You know, I think he's still in St. Joe. I heard that he was working at the track in Kansas City, and I think Geigel got him that job.
That's correct. But I don't. Jim, I was actually in touch with him last year, and after this, I'll pass on his contact info to you. Absolutely.
Oh, fantastic! Because he was such a wonderful guy, and you know, I was down there by myself, and I lived in a $145 efficiency apartment with a blow up air mattress that I used for a bed. And I remember Bob Backlund came through town and he says, "Can I stay with you, Jimmy?" And I said, "Sure." And I said, "You don't mind sleeping on an air mattress?" And he says, "No." So I had an extra double air mattress and I pumped it up and we had some beers and everything and had a chicken and went to bed. And in the morning he got up, that air mattress had a hole in it. So he had a stiff neck from sleeping on the floor all night. And then he had to drive to Texas.
Oh, geez. So Mark also wanted me to ask you, who came up with the Killer Bees name?
Oh, geez. You know, I really think it was Brian, mainly because the Miami Dolphins had the Killer Bee
yes, that's
defensive
right.
backfield, and they had guys with bees in it. So, you know, Brunzell and Blair, it just seemed natural. And thank God for Lanny Poffo, because we went to, we were doing TV, I think, in Canada, and Lanny Poffo had two of these doggone black and yellow striped pants, you know, tights. And we wound up wearing them. And that was the first time we were called the Killer Bees. And it worked out real good. And then, you know, actually, when we did the mass, which was totally different, you know, for a babyface team to use a heel gimmick, I mean, they could have gone anywhere with it. And I remember we beat the Hearts in Buffalo and on TV, and they got over, those damn masks got over, you know, like a son of a gun. And then Vince just, you know, I, to be honest with you, and I know Vince didn't like me at all, and the feelings were mutual, but and consequently, I just, you know, he led us on, you know, and we were a serviceable team, you know, worked hard every single night and had a lot of good matches there. But, you know, there was no reason why, you know, they couldn't have, you know, put the belts on us for a little bit. And then, you know, we could have lost the belts and made more of, you know, something to upcoming matches. And then, you know, it's a shame. I feel bad, you know, for Brian, because, you know, to be in the WWE Hall of Fame, you know, was very important to Brian, you know. And it'd be important to me too, but you know, it's the fact that they overlooked us and, you know, all these years. And then they, you know, they put guys in from, you know, Tennessee and Kentucky. And then, you know, people always ask us, you know, how come the Killer Bees aren't in the WWE Hall of Fame? And I said, well, simply it's my fault, because, you know, I was sort of a locker room lawyer and Vince never liked me, and you know, that was it. So you know, he sort of put up with me, but I think that was more or less the problem that we had to, you know, put up with, especially the last couple of years there. And then when Brian left after they weren't going to do anything with us, and I still needed to wrestle because I had a gym, you know, I owned my own gym from 82 to 87. So I needed that wrestling income. And then, you know, to have Vince, you know, have me do jobs on TV, you know, with various guys, you know, it hurt my pride, but I realized, you know, well, you know, I had to do it. So, you know, that's one thing that I, you know, was sad about. And at the same time, you know, it, you know, just goes to show that, you know, Vince was in control.
Yeah, so I know that we're starting to wind down, and we're so appreciative that you've taken the time to be with us today. I've got about 50 questions. I'm going to try to whittle this down. But a guy that we saw work in the territory of Florida, and Jim, surprised, you never worked a match in the state of Florida?
Never.
Yeah, I thought you did one, and I went back and I checked all the results, and I couldn't find a single one.
Well, I did with the WWE because we right. used to work Miami and the Keys. I remember every time we go to the Keys, we get drug tested the next day. That was a huge cocaine inlet, you know, in that.
No.
Yes.
Rumor has it. And yes.
Yeah. So I remember everybody who would wrestle in the Keys, you know, was extra cautious because the next day, sure enough, they drug tested.
Yeah. Well,
was there a question there?
I did. Yeah. So there is a question wrapped around that. A guy that we saw in 1976 for about 7 or 8 months was one of your old teammates, one of your old Gopher teammates, Jan Nelson. And yes. Jan was one of these guys that he good looking guy, big, kind of looked like Magnum before there was a Magnum TA. Kind of had a Tom Selleck look going. Great shape. Didn't stick around Florida for too long, but he left, and then I heard he passed away. But it's a guy that you almost never hear anything about. It confirmed he did pass away, Jim?
Yeah, he died of an overdose after a Rolling Stones concert.
That's kind of what I heard.
And it was horrible. And Jan was an All-American football player in high school. And he was touted to be a starter. And he was a mean son of a gun. He and my best man were roommates at the dormitory, and they got in a fight. And Jan bit my roommate in the back to the point where he bled. So, and Jan was 6'3 and 260 pounds. And he was a smart guy. He was an articulate guy, but he was a mean son of a gun. And I remember, I think he might have gotten a fight with Putski too. And I think he hit Putski with a 40-pound dumbbell.
Ouch.
And yeah, and that didn't wind up too well for Putski. I think that, and then I think Jan got fired. I can't remember if that was Oklahoma or where, but or Texas. But he came back and he'd hurt his back, and he and his brother took over a bar. It was called the Viking Bar in Seven Corners, right down by campus. And Jan was a huge Rolling Stone fan, and he saw him in Minneapolis, and then he went down to see him, I think, in Iowa, Des Moines, Iowa, where they played. And I heard that he had overdosed and died the next day. And I was sick. And then his brother, Scott, about 15 years later, got shot and killed at the bar. Oh. So it was horrible. But and yeah, Jan was, and yeah, he was a tough kid too. I mean, he was tough. And if he walked off the football team, and he was looking at a starting position his sophomore year as a guard, but he hated the way that it was so demanding, and he was a big outdoorsman. He loved the fish and he loved the hunt. He couldn't do it, so he just quit. He quit football, and then he you know, started wrestling. And I knew right away that the wrestling wasn't going to be his line of, you know, because his mentality was cut and dried. It was either right or wrong. And if it was wrong, he was going to fight. So, you know, it's just too bad. And I remember his wife had contacted a couple of the boys that, you know, knew him and went to school with him and asked if there was a market, you know, for his ring clothes. And I says, geez, I have no idea, you know. But, yeah, it was sad. You know, there's been, so many tragedies in wrestling, you know, with all, especially, you know, the guys, you know, give it their all. And then, you know, at the end, there's just nothing there. And a lot of that has to do with, you know, the WWE, you know, they were making, you know, it's a billion-dollar corporation. And I don't know right now, but at the time when I was there, and, you know, I wrestled from 85 really until 93, I think, or part of 94. And there just wasn't anything there in terms of, you know, any sort of something you could fall back on. You know, there was, you know, they didn't say, well, here's what you can do. You can do this. You can buy into this. You can have a retirement plan. You can have insurance policy. But their main premise was they wanted to keep you an independent contractor so they wouldn't have to take out any insurance on you. And you signed a contract that you were independent contractor. And it's funny because Brian and I sued Vince because in that contract, there was a horrible monetary part of this contract that said that we were supposed to get 25% of the gross out of outside revenue. And when we found out, we only got 8% of the net. That's what he was giving everybody. And I remember when the dolls first came out, guys, you know, guys were getting checks for $92,000. And $85,000 for a quarter, because those damn, you know, those action figures were just flying off the shelf, you know. And I remember when we got them, we were, I think, third level. I remember we got a check for $10,000, and I thought, Jesus, this doesn't seem right. And then, you know, sure enough, after we left the company, we decided that, you know, we'd have a lawyer look into it. And he read our existing contract, the first one. And he said, oh, God, he said, this amounts to indentured slavery. He says, it promises everything for the WWE, but it doesn't give you guys anything. So that's another reason why we're not in the Hall of Fame.
And sure. I think, by the way, Ben James, that answers your question that you asked related to the action figures. So my next question, my old friend, Oben Johnson. Oben is a as tough as anybody, Jim, because he is currently battling cancer. And Oben is an old fan of yours from your Mid-Atlantic days. But besides your Mid-Atlantic stuff, he wanted to ask memories of working. Oh, you probably knew this question was coming. Your Herb Abrams story of the day. How was it working for Herb?
Well, you know, Herb was a little out of control. He was a lot out of control.
I was going to say.
He had these huge ideas, and, you know, he went to Vegas and he booked the MGM auditorium and they only used half of it. And then I remember he had a number of ladies of the night waiting for him up in his suite. He had this big, beautiful suite, and he, you know, God rest his soul, he had a little substance abuse, and he was just a character. You know, he just wanted, you know, he wanted to do things that, you know, make a name for himself and splash this and splash that. And, you know, he had a good idea, but, you know, there was just no way that anybody could compete with Vince. You know, now this Impact, or not Impact, but this AIW, whatever, is the guy who owns the football team. You know, he's he's a billionaire five times over, 10 times over. So he's got a lot of money, you know, that he can afford to, seed his wrestling program. And I watch it occasionally. I don't watch any of the WWE because it's completely the same from show to show to show. And then, you know, Vince lucked out with the Fox deal for $1 billion. And now I heard he's got one with NBC coming up. So, you know, he will continue to, you know, be the only, you know, player as far as professional wrestling. But it's funny because this Gable Stevenson, that kid who just won the national championship from Minnesota, he's 6'3", 285 pounds, and just athletic as ever. And I think he was 19-0 this year. And I think his combined record over his 3 years at college is like 67-2. And he said that the WWE is going to be there for him, you know, whenever he goes. I just hope that, he understands what he's getting into in terms of, the different personality he'll be working with. And, you know, I mean, I know things have changed a lot since I've been there, but I watch the TV and you know, everybody's a heel. Nobody's a baby face. You can't coward because that's a sign of weakness. And Vince has remained true to his own conception of what he wanted to promote as professional wrestling, and you can't knock it because he's been a huge success.
So as we begin winding down, Jim, I have, first of all, I want to say, I believe you've answered the questions of Jeff Zinger and Bill Pankost. Thank you guys. I want to, our friend of the show, Benji Fido, and his son Antonio, and they wanted to know how much of did Vern play in shaping your attitudes towards the wrestling business?
Oh, geez. Well, first of all, I know Antonio is a huge wrestling fan. God bless you, Antonio. I want you to stay well and play as hard as you can. Okay? But they're right. Vern had taught us, you know, take pride in what you do. And pro wrestling is not a joke. To me, Vern taught us the right thing in terms of, you know, going out there every night trying to put the best product we could do. And at the same time, you were actually, pro wrestling is an art form. And to me, that's the way I've always approached it. And I gave my best every night because that's what I was trained to do.
Gotcha. Well, as Jeff said, we are winding up. I have one last question, and it's one of those kind of gray area type of questions. But in your book, and again, the book, if you haven't gotten the book, I encourage you to seek this book out. Jim will have copies on April the 2nd, 7 p.m., when he does the Happy Hour Captain's Corner with our old friend Nick Massey. We will post a link in our Facebook group. I encourage you to join this, support our guests. But you want to get a copy of this book because it's almost a love letter to life in a sense that this is just it's such a positive reflection. And this is the guy you are. As we're talking to you today, your book has really come to life for me in this. But you seem to have spent a lot of time in the beautiful city of Venice, Florida. And
yes.
I am born and bred in the state of Florida, and I am moving back after hellacious years of cold winter, though I'm sure your winters are 10 times worse. But I'm moving back at some point next year, and Venice is on my radar. I've spent a lot of time there. I've gone to Casperson Beach, collected shark's teeth with my kids, and I love the area. Do you still get down to Florida
And the reason I'm asking also is we run fan fests in the Tampa area. These are very small fan fests where we limit to 200 guests. And we do it so that way fans can really interact with the legends. Do you still get down to Venice? And if so, can we possibly entice you to come to one of our shows?
Well, here's the deal. My wife and I have been going down to Venice for 47 years. And my father-in-law, who passed away a number of years ago, was in the car business, and he bought a lot of property down in Florida. And he lived in a condo right on Venice Beach. So we used to go there all the time. And my mother-in-law, Mary's mom, is 97 years old and lives in Cape Coral at a assisted living. So last year, you know, because of this doggone pandemic, we had to cancel two different trips down there because we couldn't see her. The assisted living building wouldn't let anybody in. So we went down there the 8th of February this year, and actually we stayed in Naples, North Naples, and then we drove up, and then we always drove, you know, we spent the day at Venice Beach, and it's just, you know, I just love that beach. I love that city. It's a great city. And they have a place called the Crow's Nest, and it's right on the jetties there. And they have a formal dining upstairs where you can get great seafood, or they have a real nice little pub downstairs. And I used to meet Gene Okerlund, who lived 5 miles from Venice in Osprey. And every time we'd go down there, Mary and I, we'd get together with him, and he and Jeannie, we'd meet at the Crow's Nest and have a cocktail and a hamburger or whatever it was. So we went down and we spent the day down there. And I got to tell you, fellas, it was so cold in Minnesota this past winter. And the week that we were gone, it was 50 below in St. Paul, Minneapolis.
Wow.
And it was 87 degrees in Naples. It was just gorgeous. We had a great time. And my grandson had been picked. He was the only Minnesota 15-year-old player to get picked for an elite soccer tournament down in Naples. So we went down there and watched them play in four matches, and actually they lost the championship game, our match, 2-1, and it was just so fun to watch him compete because these kids were just incredible. Oh boy, they were good. And you know, it was 80 degrees at night. Something we won't see here in Minnesota for, you know, until June. Maybe, yeah, wow. Then.
So, well, Jim, listen, we certainly want to appreciate you going out of your way.
Absolutely.
And spending some time with us and going a little bit over on the time that we had originally planned for
That's
you.
That's okay. It was my pleasure.
Wow. We really enjoyed it. Thank you so much. Okay. Thank you, Jim. Barry, how great was Jim Brinsdell in that interview?
Jeff, I'm not kidding. My favorite guest of all time.
Yeah, he could not have been a nicer guy. And Barry, after we were finished recording with Jim, had said, we really hope we can get Jim to come back on with us again. And because, you know, Barry said, I got like 50 questions for the guy, and he had to narrow them down to like 5. So we've got a ton of other stuff that we can get to with Jim. But he certainly was a really, really nice man. We really appreciate him coming on. So, Barry, now as we begin to wrap up this particular segment, one or two things I did want to mention, Barry. Getting ready to go to Nashville at the time of this recording. Yeah, I'm looking forward to that. Going to try some hot chicken for the first time. And I will also be meeting for the first time, Barry, a brother shipper from the Nashville area. How about that?
Who's that going to be?
I'm not going to reveal any names just All in right. case it falls through. Next episode, you'll find out who it is. I do want to mention also, Barry, our ongoing funniest movie tournament. The day this show comes out, which is tomorrow, I can now announce to the public, Barry, round 2.
What? Today.
Yes, indeed. Now the matchups get tough. Barry, I got to tell you, the time we started recording, I noticed, unfortunately, Groundhog Day taking it on the chin from Christmas Vacation. A little surprising.
Yeah, a little surprising. And I like both. And I think you had referenced that that I do like both. I like both films tremendously. I'm a little surprised, though. I think Groundhog Day, maybe, I don't know. Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, I don't think we have enough of the people saying, if this movie does not win this poll, I've lost all faith in this group. I think I've read that about seven times.
It's now. Fixed.
Yeah, exactly.
The fix is in.
Yeah, I say exactly. Why aren't these movies seated? Yeah, that's another thing. But last thing, Barry, before we go. Barry, I know you're going to want to comment. We have a limited amount of time. I'm going to give you a chance to rant. Barry.
Yes.
Eric Bischoff, Hall of Famer.
Well, you know, considering some of the other people that are in that Hall of Fame, I don't, that's fine.
Eric fucking Bischoff in the Hall of Fame. Yeah, that's gonna,
yeah, especially the WWE Hall of Fame, yeah, which is that's the, you know, like, yeah, it's crazy. It's wrestling, Jeff, you know, at this point.
It is, you know, only in wrestling can you have an unlimited budget for a national corporation, overspend on that budget, lose the company. I will say, after he took them to where they were in the first place in the ratings and stuff like that, applause to Uncle Eric. Congratulations for that. But again, with an unlimited budget, okay, then lose millions and millions of dollars and be considered a Hall of Famer. Yeah, folks, if that's what you want, that's what you get. And, you know, just like Vince's limo driver, enjoy that Hall of Fame ring that you'll be getting. Can't wait to hear that speech. So on behalf of my co-host, Barry Rose, and the sweet man himself, our producer, Lou Kippelman, I will remind you, Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry, a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. More info when I get back from Nashville about our Patreon channel and our Patreon exclusive content that we will be offering to you sooner rather than later. Woo! Play the blues, Edge.